Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 76 of the Diamond Duo podcast. I'm Tony Puglisi, joined as always by my co-host and co-producer Tom Bauer to bring you everything that was and will be about the MLB playoffs. This episode of the Diamond Duo podcast is brought to you by Tom Bauer's FanDuel picks, Cy Youngs, postseasons, the only picks you should never trust. Not sponsored by FanDuel.
That's very important. We are not sponsored by FanDuel. No, they will never want to work with us, I bet.
That's the one thing you have to jump in on. You're not even denying your picks at this point, man.
Dude, I went 0-4, and we put that out the day before everything. We released the episode, all the f***ing series were done, and I looked really stupid when I went 0-4 on the episode, but I look stupid anyway. You never trust my picks. You can take them for a grain of salt. Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 76 of the Diamond Duo podcast. Don't take any gambling advice from me. If you hear predictions from me, run fast, run far, far away. In fact, bet the opposite of what I say, because chances are that's going to come true.
I love the irony, too, that at the end of the last episode, we were clowning on ourselves for our preseason picks. Like, when you picked Alek Manoah for Cy Young, when I picked Christian Javier, we were saying, oh, man, these picks are really bad. Oh, that's really funny, man. Anyway, let's pick again.
Yeah.
Maybe these ones will go better. Like, I'll give myself some credit. We'll get to it when we get to it. But I actually got a 50%, which this is not like school. I consider that a passing grade. Tom, on the other hand.
All I gotta say is that's a failing grade, but it's still better than a zero. So you know what? You're still shooting better.
There's one series you got wrong. I'm gonna clown the hell out of you for when we get there. I'm still shocked you picked this team when you did.
Yeah, I know what series it is too, and you actually thought it made some sense last week too. I would like to point that out.
But I didn't pick it now, did I? That's not.
Oh, you didn't pick it because you're a smart person. But I picked it, and that's the fate I had to suffer.
That's the nicest thing you've said to me in this entire podcast.
Yeah, don't get used to it, my man.
Don't get used to it. Feelings mutual, Mr. I picked the Marlins over the Phillies. Either way, let's get right into the episode so we can actually talk about these wildcard series and the divisional series that are going on now, or now at the time of recording. Hey, speaking of which, we're recording the evening of Monday, October the 9th, 2023, around 11:30, because Tom and I are really, really good at bamfing when there's no microphone on, apparently, as good as we are at bamfing when there is a microphone on. So we're recording a little late at night. The Dodgers game two, is actually going to go final probably soon, and trust me, we're going to get to that when we get to that. But yeah, anything that happens in the coming days will obviously not be covered because it hasn't happened yet. Divisional series will probably have finished. We'll recap them next time. Just want to get that out there. And second, as always, go follow us on social media. We are at Diamond Duo Pod on Twitter, /X, at The Diamond Duo Podcast on Instagram. Keep posted for show posts, updates, all that jazz. Fun stuff, should we get back to that. And most importantly, go give us a follow or a sub wherever you get your podcasts, wherever you're listening to us right now from. Apple, Spotify, we don't care, we're just happy you're listening. Give us a follow and a sub, maybe a review if you'd like. Appreciate it. Thanks for listening. All right. Those disclaimers and opening remarks out of the way, Tom, what say we dive headfirst into the segment I called What We Missed? Because as long as last episode turned out to be, particularly in the base, the Raw recording, we missed a couple things from last week, and probably the most embarrassing thing on my part, I'll happily wear this because I made the rundown, and I literally put in that rundown three managers who lost their jobs last week. I forgot the most important one. Granted, this man did not lose his job. This man willingly stepped down from his job. But Tom, we managed to talk about Buck Showalter, Gabe Kapler, and Phil Nevin. Phil Nevin, but did not manage to talk about Terry Francona. Probably the most accomplished of those three men, stepping down from his post as manager of the Cleveland Guardians to officially retire from the game of baseball. Tom, I genuinely don't know how I missed this, so apologies, ladies and gentlemen. We couldn't talk about this when it was fresh and new, but we're still going to talk about it right now. Terry Francona is no longer going to be managing Cleveland for next year. We don't know who their next manager is going to be, but Tom, another legend outright of the game. We talked about a couple of them last time on the field, but one off the field and in the dugout is going to be stepping away. And this, it still kind of feels surreal to me. I can hardly imagine an MLB landscape without Tito.
Yeah, it's surreal to me how you completely left him off of the rundown. I mean, come on, man. You're dissing the future Hall of Famer himself, one of the greatest managers of all time. And you forgot him on the rundown. Shame on you, you Gabe Kapler favoritist. I don't know.
Favoritist?
Yes, I don't know if that's a word. Okay, you said swugged was a word earlier before the episode. I need to point this out.
They don't know that, though.
Yeah, you said I swugged from my gallon of water or whatever the hell it was. And I'm like, that is not a word. And I proved it by looking it up.
I never claimed it was a real word. Whatever. I'm not malicious. I'm an idiot. Let's talk about Terry Francona. And not whatever was swugged before the episode was begun.
All right, let's actually get into it. So yeah, Terry Francona, it was long rumored that he was going to kind of be stepping away from the game. So it kind of looks like a mutual parting of ways between the Cleveland Guardians and Terry Francona, because Terry Francona has some health issues that he's got going on. He wants to be around his family and all that stuff. So I wish him nothing but the best in that regard. So again, it's a mutual parting of ways. And I believe he still wants to somewhat be in the game, just maybe not managing every day. I believe that was his intentions that he was telling people around baseball. If that does happen, remains to be seen. But what we do know is he was much beloved, and he was certainly beloved on the way out too. Cleveland gave him a rousing ovation on the final day of the season, so much so that, in fact, that he didn't want it. He tried to walk off the field, but his players blocked him and made him stand out on the field so he could get that final ovation. I believe Jose Ramirez may have been the spearheader in that, so thank you, Jose, for doing that for Terry Francona. And he got a huge ovation from the Cleveland faithful. They absolutely love him there, and everybody loves him. I mean, I didn't love him as the Red Sox manager, but I can appreciate the job that he did now, and especially just, again, from the respect level that he's garnered across baseball, whether it be the people in the media. Like, I was reading, I think it was a Tim Kirchin story, or maybe it was Buster Olney. One of them wrote up a thank you kind of on ESPN, like the day he was retiring, or maybe it was the day after, and they were just recounting the days where Terry, before he got the Cleveland job, was working with ESPN, and he was calling spring training games with one of the two, and they were just reminiscing about the good times that they had, just the personality that Tito has, because he sure as hell has it. Even if you've never experienced it, trust me, go look at the stories, you will find that he's got a hell of a personality in anything, in every single way in every single good way possible. Wow, the English is terrible. I'm trying to say he has a great personality and the words just aren't coming out right. Whoop-de-f-do. This is what happens when you record at 11:30 at night. But anyway, because we forgot this last week and I want to speed this up. Tito, hell of a career. I don't have the numbers in front of you, but we definitely know he's going to be a future Hall of Famer. I believe he's in top 10 in wins in Major League Baseball history. If not, then that's a damn shame. But yeah, Tito, congratulations on the retirement. Hoping nothing but the best for you.
10,000%, yes. Absolutely. Probably the greatest active manager still in the game, you know, for the time being, Tom. I've got the numbers in front of me, so just super duper quick before we move on. He is a two-time World Series champ. Tom hinted at it earlier. His time with the Boston Red Sox resulted in him helping them break the curse, actually in his first year with the team, won another ring in 2007. And what most people will remember, at least, you know, younger fans, almost broke another curse, this time with the Cleveland Guardians back in 2016. As happy as I was for the Cubs, man, it just hurt to see Cleveland lose. Another hexed team, so to speak, so many years without a title. I would hope Tito would be the one to bring them all the way, but you know what? He still cut them damn far, their most successful season in decades, and just a very beloved man around the game. Three-time manager of the year, too. That just goes to show how amazing a manager he was throughout his time. So yeah, Terry Francona, congratulations on an unforgettable career. You're absolutely right, Tom. He's a surefire Hall of Famer. 1,950 wins in the book. I think that'll be enough to get him there. Now, this would be the part of the show where I hope Terry Francona would, you know, ride off into the baseball sunset on his scooter that everybody knows he likes to ride. Everyone on baseball social media has seen it. Everyone loves it. But I can't say that, Tom, because some dickhead in Cleveland actually stole Terry Francona's scooter. If memory serves, this is not even the first time it was taken, which I'm going to be honest, it's a little funny. I don't like that he got his property stolen, but the fact that this has happened twice now, I don't know why, it's a little humorous to me. But moreover, you enlightened me not just to this story, but to a certain accent to the story, Tom. What is that? What happened to the scooter?
So not only was it stolen for the second time that you were saying, I'm going to read Francona's exact quote, but this time they stripped it. Looks like they took a baseball bat to it, and the worst part was that they defecated on it. That was what Terry Francona said. Now, I'm assuming he got actually the scooter back. Initially, I thought he didn't get the scooter back. And then I was going to go into this whole conspiracy theory of how the hell they figured out that somebody took a shit on a scooter and he somehow didn't get it back and we can't actually tell the tale. But maybe it is one of Tito's tall tales for all we know. But from Tito's mouth to God's ears, apparently somebody took a shit on his scooter. And I don't even want to know how the hell this even happened, but we can confirm that it was stolen yet again before he was set to leave the game, retire, whatever you want to call it. And yes, somebody took a sh** on his scooter. I repeat for a fourth time, somebody took a sh** on a future Hall of Fame manager's scooter after they stole it and beat it up with a baseball bat.
I want to meet that guy. Like, what was going through his head when he steals a scooter and he first, like not to, like, befriend him. I just want to know, like, what went through your head when you stole this scooter and your first thought was, you know what? You know what's missing here? It's just a weird story. We obviously don't know much more about it. Don't know if the guy was caught. Don't know if Terry's going to be able to get it fixed. But God, what a weird way to leave the game of baseball, at least from a managerial standpoint. But hey, I guess you can call that a Cleveland goodbye.
You know, I think my favorite part of you retelling this story is that you said, I want to meet the guy. No, not the future Hall of Famer you want to meet. You want to meet the guy that took a shit on his scooter, because apparently that's a lot more interesting than meeting Terry Francona, one of the most interesting men in the world, who should start doing those Dos Equis commercials that they used to run for the most interesting man in the world. Terry Francona can take his place, and I would be so happy with that.
Well, okay, if it's a choice between the two of them, I'm picking Francona over the guy who shits on scooters. But if I just got the chance to meet him, period, I just want to pick his brain. Like, hey, man, what's wrong with you? Why are you doing this? Why are you shitting on scooters? Like, if I got to talk to Terry Francona instead, I'd take that 20 times out of 10. Talk about, hey, man, why'd you have to ruin my childhood dreams and make the Red Sox good, huh? God, no, that's... Just a weird way for him to go out. I would say for the city of Cleveland, rather fitting, to quote a famous YouTube video from God knows how many years ago, they apparently have one building. So, God, weird story, weird mishaps with Tito's scooter, but still a fantastic career for Terry Francona. Congratulations again. Now, guess what, Tom?
What?
Someone else got fired since the last time we recorded.
We're not the day that it came out, like always.
The first day it's out. Don't you love it? But we're not, apparently not out of the executive branch neck of the woods yet. And not even from the same part of baseball. Because Tom, if you remember, one of the individuals we talked about last episode was Buck Showalter, who lost his job. Well, the Mets are clearly not done clearing house because Billy Epler, their former GM, is now gone. Gone amidst a scandal of, and I quote, improper injury list placements. We don't know any further details about this particular investigation, what he was accused of. I mean, we know what he was accused of, but we don't have specific anecdotes and incidents or examples. So David Sturz comes in, Tom, and immediately Showalter and Epler are shown the door.
This is a weird one. Now, I'm going to put scandal in air quotes here for this whole situation, because let's be honest. Every team probably violates the injury list placements in some sort of regard. Now, probably. Somebody obviously had it out for Billy Epler. Quite frankly, it could have been Buck Showalter when he was being shown the door. Maybe somebody called him up, or he called up Major League Baseball, and he didn't like Billy Epler. Maybe they didn't get along, and he said, yeah, you know what? I'm taking you out with me, buddy. So, David Stearns is hired, and yeah, Buck was shown the door. We kind of knew he wanted to bring in his manager, and it looks like it's going to be Craig Counsell. I mean, it's probably the biggest secret that's not a secret in baseball right now, that the Mets are probably going to land Craig Counsell. But the big one was Billy Epler stepping away, and we thought maybe it was a power struggle at first. Maybe their philosophies differed, because David Stearns was going to be the president of baseball ops, and it looked like he was going to keep Billy Epler there as his GM. After all, he does have a solid enough track record as a general manager. You would think that maybe he would give him a chance. But then this scandal comes out, and he says he wants to, or actually beforehand, Billy said something along the lines of he wants to give David a clean slate or something like that. And we're like, what does that mean? Well, now we know what it means, because obviously the next day it was revealed that the scandal, quote unquote, began, and Major League Baseball began their investigation. And now we'd also like to point out David Stearns obviously wasn't a part of this investigation. Steve Cohen is also not a guilty party in this investigation as well. Major League Baseball already cleared his name in this whole thing. He said there's no wrongdoings on the part of Steve Cohen. So again, we don't really know exactly the case of why there was issues and all that stuff. And what also came out is it looks like there were some tensions, and again, this is why, again, this is just a conspiracy theory that I'm pointing out, that Buck Showalter may have been the one who leaked on Billy Epler to Major League Baseball, because apparently there was some reports that there were some quarrels between Billy Epler and Buck Showalter in terms of lineup management. Specifically, most notably, it's reported over Daniel Vogelbach, of all people. That's where we draw the line, is Daniel Vogelbach's place in the lineup. This is where we have an issue, because apparently Billy Epler stressed that he wanted Daniel Vogelbach to play. It possibly could have, oh, actually, I'm reading a quote from the New York Post right now. The 30-year-old slumped early in the season, and manager Buck Showalter, according to a source, again of the New York Post, met resistance from general manager Billy Epler at various points when trying to employ options other than Vogelbach at DH against right-handed pitching. Showalter was told he had to play Vogelbach, the source said. Part of the manager's opposition to Vogelbach was philosophical, colon. Showalter viewed the DH spot as one that should be used on a rotation, allowing position players a partial rest while remaining in the lineup. Kind of agree with that, also kind of disagree, but you have it there for whatever reason, so you can DH whoever you want. I'm surprised it's not really just the case isn't coming down to he wanted to play the younger guys. No, it had to come down to who he wanted at his designated hitter, which again could have been the younger guys. But still, this is kind of a situation where I feel like we're not being given all the details, at least not yet, if ever at all. So I feel like there's something missing from the story, because if Buck is really going to the Post in Major League Baseball over Daniel Vogelbach's place in the lineup? No, I don't buy that at all. That could have just been one thing that maybe Buck complained about, but something's missing, I'm feeling.
This definitely seems like one piece of a puzzle, you know? Like, there's definitely a whole picture you should be able to see if we knew the entire story, but obviously I doubt the Mets want that all out there. I doubt Major League Baseball wants that all out there. So it just comes down to, you kind of have to imply something fishy, something not so great was going on behind the scenes. Maybe not everyone was getting along, and it's now led to basically a complete purge of the Mets' old guard. If Vogelbach was that stake being driven between the two of them, though, I'm not going to lie, that's kind of funny. Probably the most ineffectual Met of the entire season is the reason. I'm not ready to believe that he's the only reason, or if he's even a substantial, significant reason, period. But the fact that he was name-dropped, I don't know, that does make it sound like it was at least a consistent hindrance to Buck, if what Tom just read is actually true. And just circling back to Billy Epler for a second, the fact that he was called out and, let's say, mired in this quote-unquote scandal for injury-list manipulation, that kind of leads me to believe that, yeah, it's definitely something a little more going on behind the scenes. Like, because like you said, Tom, literally everybody does this. If you folks didn't know, there's literally a term for it. It's called a phantom IL stint. It's whether or not typically happens when either a player is struggling or a baseball team wants to manipulate a roster in a certain way, and they just kind of put someone on IL for, oh yeah, groin tightness or something. Oh, he hyperextended his leg. I don't know. They bring him back when they have everything squared away and figured out. No one's ever admitted to that. No one's ever said, like, oh yeah, we've done that in the past. But it's kind of a quiet secret, you know? Like service time manipulation. It was like that. So the fact Billy Epler got called for that leads me to believe that this is a, we want to get rid of him and we need a big scary term to pin to him. All these shenanigans going on within the Mets organization just leads me to believe that the Mets are still somehow a Mets. Good job. A mess. Even after they haven't played baseball in a couple weeks now.
Listen, luckily for you, Mess, M-E-S-S, and Mets, M-E-T-S, are synonyms. In fact, they are practically the same word. So it doesn't matter. You can say Mess, Mets, whatever. We know exactly what you're talking about. But the last thing I'll just say about this is, you mentioned it, like, other teams aren't going to obviously admit to anything happening. Again, this has happened throughout the entire league. And if you look back on another historical example that happened just a few years ago, and it's one we've talked about on this podcast, was electronics being used in baseball. There's the issue with the Yankees, the Red Sox, most notably Houston. But those three teams probably weren't the only teams manipulating things in some way, shape, or form. Again, these are just my opinions, not necessarily cold hard facts. But again, I find it hard to believe that it's just the Mets having this issue. And like you said, no one's going to admit to actually doing this because then they can be properly investigated and then there'll be a whole scandal. You don't want that. Yeah, it's going to happen in other organizations, whether we hear about it or not. Billy Epler just got snitched on. That's what happened here.
Yep, that's really what it all comes down to. Let's get through one more quick story, Tom, before we get into the postseason that's been happening. And this is a pretty quick one, and we're actually staying in the NL East because we got to talk about two pitchers who will not, sadly, be having much of an impact on the NL East for the next year. Those pitchers being Sandy Alcantara and Kyle Wright of the Marlins and Braves, respectively, because it has been reported that neither men will throw a baseball professionally in 2024. Alcantara was hit with the dreaded Tommy John. I believe it's the first time he's gotten it. Tom, please correct me if I'm wrong. I don't have it pulled up. But he'll be going under the knife for Tommy John. And Kyle Wright, this one was actually reported a little more recently. All I was able to find, is that he's undergoing shoulder surgery. I wasn't able to get anything more specific than that. If you were paying attention to the Braves at all, or you were unfortunate enough to roster Kyle Wright in fantasy baseball, you know for a fact he was on the field, off the field, hit the 60-day IL very early on. And just never saw consistent playing time, Tom. I think he only pitched like two games or something like that. And it's sad to say, but outside of that one year, I believe it was last year where he broke out and looked like a bona fide superstar at the position, it's really been the story of his career. And now his entire age 29 season is going to be wiped clean because of surgery. Not really a ton to add here, just sad to see two, I dare say, some of the best pitchers in the National League East when they're healthy are not going to be on the baseball field for the next season.
I'll talk about Wright first just because I have a Fan Nation article from Sports Illustrated pulled up about him. Yes, it's confirmed he's going to have shoulder surgery. He's missing the entire season next year. There was an MRI that revealed damage. Like you mentioned, Kyle Wright last season, he had 21 wins, which led all of Major League Baseball. He's had shoulder issues, it looks like, for over a year now. He didn't actually make two appearances this season, like you were saying. He actually made 7 starts, 9 appearances in total. He was not good at all. He had a 6.97 ERA and a 1-3 record. Not good in the slightest. Yikes. But if you're having shoulder issues, then, yeah. This is going to clear up the timeline for you a little bit. He had lingering, I'm reading directly from the Braves Today article, which is written by Lindsey Crosby. Let me start reading. He had lingering soreness after last year's postseason, which bothered him enough to get a cortisone injection in January. The necessary, quote, quiet period, end quote, after the injection delayed the start of his spring training ramp-ups, and he ended up opening the season on the injured list. He was finally activated in early April. He made 5 starts for Atlanta before being placed directly on the 60-day IL with right shoulder inflammation. And then it goes on to talk about his starts. He returned to the active roster in September, 4 months after his IL placement. He lost his first two starts, both against Philly, before he was moved to the bullpen. He actually did good in the bullpen in his 5 1/3 innings, and so his shoulder gave him issues, and that's why he is missing next season. So, a lingering issue for Kyle Wright, that sucks, because we know the talent he can have. A little bit concerning given his injury history. He's only thrown 1 year where he's had more than, I can say, thrown in, actually, I'm just going to say 8 starts, and it was last year. And then in 2020, he threw in 8 starts, and that was the COVID year. But still, not a guy who's seen a lot of the mound for the 5th overall pick back in 2015. So that sucks for Kyle Wright. As for Sandy Alcantara, or Alcantara, however the hell you say his name, I always pronounce it wrong. Tony, remember earlier in the year when we did the top 24 players in baseball? Remember where we placed Sandy Alcantara?
Oh god, Alcantara, that's definitely wrong. I actually don't. I remember him being there. I want to say we put him at like 21? Something like that? It couldn't have been too high.
Oh, it was higher than 21, I can tell you that much.
Wait, that's going to be another good thing to react to. We should do that. In the podcast and not, like, come the end of the year, we should look back on that, see how poorly that's aged. I distinctly remember putting Manny Machado at 5. Either way, I'm going to guess Sandy got, like, 17, if it's not 21.
He was number 13 on our list.
13? Oh my god, we got recency bias. Jesus Christ. We do that again next year. We got to take like the last 2 years into account.
Oh my god. Yeah, this list is something. I'm just going to... you know what? We'll save it for a rainy day. The next highest pitcher, instead of Shohei, who we obviously put at 1, was number 9. It was Justin Verlander we placed there as the 9th best player in baseball. That did not turn out well at all. Jacob DeGrom was 12, and Max Scherzer was on this list, too. There are some other pitchers that were on this list, and Gerrit Cole was an honorable mention, and he's going to only win the Cy Young, probably unanimously.
To be fair, we were both in agreement on that, because in the years past, he was always good, but
yes,
struggled with the homer. I believe you were actually the one that nixed him on the list.
I did, and I do not regret that, because look at what happened. He won the Cy Young. Also, look at what happened to Yankee the bed. Anyway, Sandy, Sandy Alcantara. I'm looking exactly at the pronunciation on Baseball Reference. I'm still going to f*** it up. I'm just going to call him Sandy. Sucks to be him. Somehow he only had 3.4 WAR this year, even though he had like a 4.14 ERA. Definitely a step down for him, but he did go under the knife already. He's going to miss all of next season. Again, nothing but the best for him. The Marlins will surely miss him, but at least they have pitching depth, although it's going to significantly, I do believe, hurt their odds at making the postseason next year, if you even think they have odds to begin with. So that's that. Tony, any other words that you want to say about Kyle Wright and Sandy Alcantara?
I'll throw a few Alcantara's way. If only because I kind of want to respond to what you said towards the end that it might hamper their playoff chances. I beg to differ. Me thinking the Marlins will go far in the playoffs is a little presumptuous because of what they just showed us on the national stage. We'll get to that in a minute. But as we're about to talk about, the Marlins' big problem is hitting. I truly believe if their starting rotation gets healthy next year, sans Alcantara, they could still be pretty good. Yuri Perez broke out big last year. They've still got Jesus Luzardo, who was, for the most part, pretty respectable. And that's not even including Braxton Garrett and Edward Cabrera, both of them could be taking big steps next season, as this year was their first real taste at a full major league workload. So without Alcantara, it's definitely going to be harder for them to compete, but I think they've at least got a shot. And they've also got Max Meyer coming off of Tommy John surgery next year. Former number 3 overall pick. That kid looked like a stud before he got hurt. So if I were the Marlins, I would focus on hitting. Get people who don't suck in the playoffs. That's Chisholm. Sorry, I got this tickle in my throat. Sorry, man. Allergy season, you know?
It's all good. It's all good. I feel like that tickle's going to be back in your throat, though, in about like a half hour or so when we talk about the Marlins in the wild card series.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Maybe not. Who knows? Either way, let's actually jump into that wild card series, or just the wild card series in general, because that's pretty much all we missed. Thankfully, it wasn't that much outside of, you know, Terry Francona, probably the most accomplished manager of either of our lifetimes, or one of them anyway. Good job, me. But nevertheless, let's get into the playoffs, Tom. We're going to go to the wild card series first, and then we're going to jump into the divisional series as they stand right now, because right now only 2 games for that series, each series, I should say, is done. The wild card, since it'll be pretty old news by the time the episode drops. We're gonna try and not spend too much time on it. Just gonna devote a couple minutes to each series, and then we'll give a stand as to where each team is. Tom, let's go. I'm gonna kick us right off with the first series I've mentioned here, and I normally throw it to you when I bring in segments, but I wanted to be the first to talk about Texas versus Tampa.
Of course you did.
Oh, because for you lovely listeners who remember, Tom and I both had our World Series pick coming out of this series. That mine was Texas, and Tom's was Tampa's.
Great.
Now, one of these teams committed four errors in Game 1 and looked like a f***ing AAA team, and I'm going to give you a hint, folks, it wasn't my team. It was Tom Bauer's Tampa Bay Rays. Yes, the Texas Rangers absolutely had their way with the Rays, sweeping them in two games to go on to the ALDS. Tom, if you ask me, this series was not particularly close, like, even a little bit. There were moments when the Rays looked like a decent team. This is actually the series I think I paid most attention to because it was during the afternoon. You know, by the time my work was winding down, you know, around 3:30, 4 o'clock, all you gotta do is pull up MLB Game Day and bang! He had a fast track of getting to 5:30 just a wee bit faster. But nevertheless, some highlights from this series include Yankees legend, and this supremely pains me to say this, but Yankees legend Jordan Montgomery out-dueling Tyler Glasnow in Game 1. I'm quite sure he went 8 innings. I'm pulling up the box score right now. It's just loading. No, actually, forgive me. He went 7 innings. Oh, even better. Only to give way to another Yankees legend in Aroldis Chapman to get the hold in the 8th. Oh, man. But the Rays had no chance all game. They only scattered 6 hits across the entire game. Tyler Glasnow was great until he wasn't. He does not do well deep into games, and the Rays learned that the hard way. And they took Game 1 easily. Game 2 was a massacre, but I've been talking quite a bit, Tom. Why don't you take it over from here? Give your thoughts on this series to see your World Series favorites, see how they did.
Yeah, part of the reason why I picked the Rays was I thought their offense was on a whole nother level this year compared to years past. By the way, I'll point this out, too, for the Toronto series that we're going to get to in a minute. I believe all of the American League East teams are now on losing streaks in the postseason. I believe the Rays and the Blue Jays each sit at 7, or one of them sits at 6 or 5, but I'm sure the Rays are the team with the longest losing streak. That might be at 7. Oh, they are. Thank you for clarifying that. And again, I thought it was because the offense could get it done. But shout out Randy Arozarena, Curtis Meade, and Isaac Paredes, because they were the only offense that contributed to the Rays in this entire series. They scored 1 run in 2 games. They lost 4-0 and 7-1. And believe it or not, the 4-0 game, that's where all the fielding errors happened. So whoop-de-doo. Oh my god, that's what killed them in that game, was the 4 errors, obviously. And then they just couldn't get it done against the Rangers, which is a recurring theme that seems to be happening throughout the Rangers in this postseason run. But they scored 1 run the entire postseason series. They got 14 hits combined as a team throughout the 2 games. The Rangers got 21, if you're keeping track at home. It just wasn't their series. It looked like they showed no sign of life. In fact, before looking at the box score right now, I was pretty sure Randy Arozarena was the only sign of life they had on offense in this entire series. I'm honestly shocked that I can add 2 more names to that discussion. What can I say? I mean, I picked them to World Series, so that was the kiss of death right there. But they did not come to play. That's really what happened in the series. The Rangers did. They got out to a very hot start, and they did not let go of the gas pedal. So, you know, that's just what happens sometimes in the postseason. Like, you gotta be ready to play, even if it's only for 19,000 fans. What the hell, Tampa? I know it was 3 p.m. on, like, a random-ass day in the middle of the week. You couldn't muster more asses in seats. I know your stadium sucks. I know I'm pretty sure you put tarps on the top deck, but what the actual hell? And the Rays couldn't even garner 20,000 fans. That was a pathetic excuse of a crowd. And honestly, it makes me scared for what's going to happen to them when they get a new stadium in St. Petersburg. Because I think it's going to be the exact same thing that happens. It's the same thing I pointed out when we talked about that, how the Marlins got the new stadium. They had a lot more issues with their stadium than the Rays possibly will have, but still, they can't attract a crowd either. In fact, they have worse problems. But they had no home field advantage, and they couldn't get anything going. There was no sign of life. In Texas, credit to them. They took advantage of that, and in fact, they just completely ran away with the entire series. I mean, Evan Carter was the hero here. I'll let you talk about him, Tony, because I've spewed on about the Tampa Bay Rays enough. It was just sheer dominance. That's all the series was.
It really, really wasn't close, and it's got me, honestly, Tom, a little concerned about the Rays long term. I mean, as a Yankee fan, this makes me very happy, but as a fan of the game of baseball, it's got me concerned about the Rays long term, because for those keeping track at home, this is now the second playoff series in a row where Tampa looked like a sneaky good pick to go to the World Series, or at least make some noise, upset a couple teams, only to promptly die offensively. They've done this 2 years in a row now. At least this year it was to someone competent. Last year it was to the Cleveland Guardians, a team who only won because they were slightly less bad offensively. I don't know what happens. They look great all season. Tom, you said it. Arozarena, Paredes, Josh Lowe, Yandy Diaz is going to get MVP votes. I don't know what happens to these guys in the playoffs. I don't know. Is it the manager? Is it the big stage? Is it the lack of a home field? Home field advantage, you know what I mean. I don't know. It just seems like the Rays are snake bitten right now. I don't know what's going to get them out of this funk. Maybe a new wave of young prospects. I mean, it would really help if they had a bright young shortstop of the future who wasn't a total f***ing piece of s*** in terms of breaking the law. That probably would have helped them. But literally everything could have gone better for the Rays. It just sucks that they're actually pretty respectable season is going to be forgotten for, like, what, the fourth season and fifth in 5 years? I don't know. But before we move on to the next series, Tom, like you said, I do want to gush about the Rangers a little bit because they looked really good.
Yeah.
And I want to give a shout out to a few players. You mentioned one of them, Evan Carter. We didn't mention him a ton in the regular season because he was one of those late September call-ups, and it was a big deal. Dude's one of the top prospects in baseball, Texas's number one prospect, and he was set to be that big outfielder of the future, like Acuna was to Atlanta. Not quite on the same level, but still franchise-changing levels of talent. Well, he's putting all of those abilities on display in the playoffs. In the wildcard series, I believe he broke a record, Tom. I believe he reached base like 4 or 5 times consecutively, and that was the most by a rookie ever.
Mm-hmm.
That in and of itself was really impressive. He wanted to have an amazing, amazing wildcard series. His slash line was a 750 average, an 875 on base, and a 2000 slugging percentage. He got out one time in the series, and that has since ballooned, we're going to talk about the divisional series in a minute, to a 500 average, a 706 on base, and a 1100 slugging. Again, it's gone down, obviously, but the fact that he's kept that kind of a pace through 8 games is kind of ridiculous. He's also got 11 bases. Tom, he's got more bases than games played. That's kind of nutty. So, Evan Carter's been fantastic. I already shouted out Yankees legends Jordan Montgomery and Aroldis Chapman. Also shout out to notorious Yankee murderer Nathan Eovaldi, who went the f*** to town in Game 2. Montgomery had a great Game 1. Well, Eovaldi, he was kind of rusty in the regular season when he came back from injury, shook off all those demons, went 6 2/3 of basically scoreless baseball. He coughed up that one run, but it wouldn't mean anything. He struck out 8. Just the Rangers offense, man, the entire time was terrifying. There was not an easy out in that line, unless you count Robbie Grossman, who Bochy was hitting 3rd for some reason against a righty. Don't ask me why he did that, but hey, he won. So yeah, that's Texas, and I almost said Toronto twice. Jesus Christ, Tampa Bay. Kind of a one-sided slaughtering, and not a great look for you, Tom. So yeah, that's kind of all I have to say about Texas-Toronto. Jesus Christ, not Toronto, man. Tampa. I did this literally twice in a take that we're taking out of the episode, but Tampa, Tampa Bay, and Texas. That's pretty much all I've got to say. Tom, if you've got anything to say, just feel free to shout it out before we move on.
I also wanted to give a shout out, and we're going to do this again later in the episode, to Corey Seager in this series, because the dude is taking his MVP esque season in the regular season, and he has not stopped throttling the acceleration button, whatever's going on in his system. He took it to the max in the playoffs. He was just as well as Evan Carter was. He actually had three doubles in the entire series of his four hits. He scored two of the runs.
Wow.
No home runs. I mean, it was a 500 batting average, a 600 OBP, and 875 slugging for him in that series. And the other thing I just wanted to say, oh yeah, Leody Taveras, I'll give him some love too. He had, and Josh Jung, wow. Yeah, this offense really was potent.
Whole lineup, man, yeah.
Yeah, listen, there's a reason why they invented the Team Silver Slugger Award, and it was for teams like the Texas Rangers, also the Atlanta Braves, but they really haven't done that well this postseason so far. Let's be real. They may have just won Game 2 tonight of the NLDS, but they got lucky at the end that they came up clutch. The Rangers' offense is playing exactly how they should be this postseason. They're living up to their name and are doing what the Braves should be doing to the Philadelphia Phillies in the NLDS. We will get to that when we get to that. But Tony, I'm going to let you start with this one because you gave me the initial idea about this series when we were texting about it tonight. So I'm going to let you throw to it. You might not be able to hear what's about to happen, at least on your end, but everybody else sure will be.
Absolutely, Tom, because I actually want to open this with a question addressed to the Toronto Blue Jays as a whole. Hey, Toronto. Who's the team that just humiliated you on a national scale and got their first playoff win in a generation at your expense?
Minnesota!
Hey, that's right! It's the Minnesota Twins! The team that quite literally everybody counted out the second they went in. I'm not discounting myself, and I'm not discounting Tom. We had the exact same argument of win a goddamn playoff game and we'll believe in you. Well, guess what? Minnesota, after 18 consecutive playoff losses, finally took it to heart. And they didn't just win one, they won two. They've actually won three since. But again, we'll get to that third win later. This wildcard series, Tom, was a joke. Of all these series that were at least a little contentious in some way, this series was a f***ing joke. In a way, I'm worried about Tampa. I am equal parts mad at the Blue Jays as a fan of baseball. As a Yankees fan, I'm loving this, but as a fan of baseball, God, man, why is this team still so bad when it matters most? Do you remember last year when they blew a goddamn 8-run lead to the Seattle Mariners in a game where if the Mariners won, they would have been eliminated? This team clearly still doesn't have it. I don't know what it is, or actually, I have a theory as to what it is, but we'll get to that when we get to game two. Goddamn, I would go through game one, game two, but I'm just looking at their batting through this series, and it's disgusting. I honestly, if I was a Blue Jays fan, I'd probably puke all over my screen. Brandon Belt got 8 at-bats, and he struck out 5 times.
Ooh.
God, Vlad Guerrero Jr. had negative win probability added, 7 at-bats, 1 hit, and it was a useless double. Oh, and he also walked once. Oh, silly me. He walked one time. God, you know when your second best hitter is Kevin Kiermaier, something is earnestly wrong. Let's go through the games real quick. Game one was horrible from the Blue Jays. I'm speaking from the Blue Jays perspective right now because the bats jumped on Kevin Gausman early. And by the bats, I mean Royce Lewis. Literally just Royce Lewis finally had a healthy enough season where he could contribute, and by God did he. Shout out to him, 2 home runs in this game. He was the entire offense. Literally, they couldn't shut down one guy, and that was it. Pablo Lopez on the other side shut down all of Toronto's lineup. That was the difference maker. They did get one run across, but who cares? You lose 3-1. Oh, maybe game two will be much better. Tom, what I'm about to describe, and then throw immediately to you, because I want your input on this too. What I'm about to describe is a decision up there with Buck Showalter playing Zach Britton over Ubaldo Jimenez in a do-or-die game. You have Jose Berríos, who is dealing after 3 innings. He was bad last season, and this is his former team. Maybe they know him, all that. This man cruised through 3 innings. Fewer than 50 pitches. Your bullpen would have been gassed in a potential game 3 if you pull him there, and he only lets up 1 walk in the 4th inning to Royce Lewis. Explain to me why John Schneider pulls him for a Yusei Kikuchi who was horrible in September, never came out of the bullpen, and is basically a lefty specialist when they only had 1 f***ing lefty coming up. Make that make sense. I don't understand. Of course Minnesota capitalizes on it. And of course Toronto gets so snake-bitten by that moment, they don't score a goddamn run. They don't score once. They get shut out in their final game 2-0 by the Minnesota goddamn Twins. I thought last year was embarrassing for them, Tom. This might honestly top them. At least the Mariners were a formidable team at the time they faced them. This was the Minnesota Twins. The last time they won was when Moneyball happened. This may be up there with some of the most embarrassing defeats in baseball history, man. I mean that earnestly.
Okay, first of all, before I get into the whole Jose Berríos thing, I want to correct you on one thing you said at the beginning of this discussion.
What's that?
We did not give the Twins any shed of light last episode. We glossed over that series prediction so quickly. You may have said that if they win a game, they have a chance. I said no such thing. I thought this was a cakewalk because of it's the AL Central. The Twins bats are absolute dog. And they were by a batting average perspective. But what I fail to discount this year is that their OBP and their team stats are actually within the top 12 of baseball. I think their OBP was like 12th or something like that, or it was 9th. Like, their slugging and all that, it was actually pretty solid this year. So maybe I was just giving them a little bit of, I was kind of glossing over them. But you know what? As the president said at one point,
Minnesota!
Yes, Minnesota. I didn't give you enough credit. Joe did. I didn't. That's on me. But, never thought I'd be bringing Joe Biden into the Diamond Duo podcast, but here we are. I'll get to the whole Jose Berríos thing in a minute, because that's really kind of the hot button topic. Game one, I just wanted to give Pablo Lopez a quick shout out. He came to the stadium in a Johan Santana jersey that was of his idol growing up. And I think from that moment, we kind of should have known that something that night was going to be conjured up spectacularly by Pablo Lopez. And he has been the, I think, possibly, outside of any Texas Ranger, possibly the best player this postseason. And this goes in both series, and we will get to why in a little bit. But Pablo Lopez is the absolute deciding factor in game one. He went 5 2/3 innings. He had 3 strikeouts. He only gave up a run, but he pitched really solidly. Actually, I'm sorry. I should give more credit to where credit's due, because that was the only time an earned run. Actually, scratch out, a single run was given up was when Pablo Lopez was on the mound. The bullpen shut it down from there for the Minnesota Twins. Props to them, because that was the sketchiest part of their team. They actually have a solid enough rotation that, again, I never gave credit to. But you gotta give credit to where credit's due. Pablo Lopez, whether it be him, Bailey Ober, whether it be Kenta Maeda if he's healthy and doesn't pitch like dog shit, whether it's Sonny Gray. I was about to say a completely different name, but you gotta give it to them. They actually have a competent rotation, and it showed because each of their starters at least went 5 innings in this series. Now, on to game two, because this kind of goes into the whole Toronto Blue Jays discussion. I'm going to actually make an executive decision, and we're going to hear from Blue Jays GM Ross Atkins, courtesy of TSN, because he talks about John Schneider's decision to pull Jose Berríos from game two of the AL wildcard series, because his thoughts are kind of shocking for a general manager. Tony, I'm sorry if you can't hear it. Here we go.
As it relates to the meeting, those meetings are John Schneider's meetings. He has a group of individuals that he prepares with every day. His process, routine, his preparation was no different that day. The group is the staff that's on the field. It's not the front office. I do not attend these meetings, and I certainly do not make those decisions. When that decision occurred, I found out about it when you did. When Yusei was getting warm in the first inning, it was obviously very clear that we had a strategy to potentially deploy. There was no plan to concretely deploy that. John Schneider made that decision to deploy that, and that's what occurred.
So in other words, Ross Atkins is throwing his manager completely under the bus and taking zero responsibility for what happened whatsoever in this entire situation, which I find BS. The nastiest, most pungent BS in all of this series, possibly. You have had to have known there was some possibility that any sort of strategy like that could have happened. You are the general manager. You make calls on who you hire, how you run your analytics department. In fact, you hired John Schneider yourself a year ago. You knew his tendencies. You're the man who made all these decisions happen. You have to be the one to take responsibility. Now, not every decision that happens in a game will always fall on the GM. I completely understand that. But don't try and completely throw John Schneider under the bus. Don't try and say that you were the one that didn't know about it. I found out when you guys did. Bull you did. Liar, liar, liar. I'd also like to point out, this is completely unrelated. He made other comments this week. We're not going to get into it. Pretty much saying what's going to happen with the Blue Jays next season. And he completely just pretty much, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, I wish I did, where he pretty much just said, yeah, we're not bringing back Matt Chapman, Brandon Belt, and Kevin Kiermaier. We're going to try and figure this thing out. I don't know how the hell they're going to do that, if they're planning on spending in free agency or not, but that's exactly what he made it sound like. So Blue Jays fans, I hope you enjoyed this run that you got now in the team you have, because you might not have it for very long. Actually, you might not have it at all ever again because of Ross Atkins. Remember his name and you can say Fire Atkins next year. Any rate. This decision was controversial, and John Schneider went on to say it was kind of the analytics that led him towards this decision. And this is where you kind of have to play the game of you have to use analytics, but you also have to manage the game and look exactly what's happening. Now, to be fair to John Schneider, the analytics were technically correct in the fact that, yeah, no runs were given up, and not many runs were really given up afterwards. So in reality, the call wasn't that bad on a box score point of view, being that Minnesota only went on to score 2 runs. But your offense was shut out. So that's kind of where everything is being brought to light. It's really on your offense, lack thereof, that lost you that game and obviously the series. Because if you're giving up 5 runs in a series and you're losing that series, something is seriously wrong. The Minnesota Twins simply pitched better than the Toronto Blue Jays in the series. That's what won them the series, because their offense carried, but honestly, in my opinion, didn't do enough to truly impress me. It just made me embarrassed for any Blue Jays fan that was watching that game to see what exactly happened. But I don't agree with the Jose Berríos decision. He went, well, you got to keep him out there, especially again when Yusei Kikuchi is the pitcher you're going to throw right after him. Not necessarily a great decision based on the year he's had, and obviously I believe he was the one who gave up the runs, so there you go.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a combination of things for the Blue Jays that ultimately culminated in a terrible, terrible, terrible week for them.
I could not have said that better myself. It honestly gave me shades of, you remember when Kevin Cash took Blake Snell out of a World Series game?
I sure do.
Yeah. What is it with AL East managers always making bonehead decisions and thinking, oh, the analytics told me to do it? No, your goddamn GM misinterpreted a computer and then told you to do it. And I don't buy that crap with Ross Atkins either. I'm not going to get into it because your thoughts are essentially mine. And we've got a couple more series to get into. I'll wrap up my thoughts with this. Oh, by the way, one quick thing about the Blue Jays. They left 18 men on base.
Oh my God.
18! They got 9 hits in game 2. Not a single runner came to the plate. That I'm gonna be honest, dude. The Blue Jays might be the new Twins at this point. The whole, like, oh, good, but never good enough. I don't trust that core of Bichette and Guerrero to go anywhere at this point. Prove me wrong. Actually, don't. As a Yankees fan, your suffering is hilarious. As much as we're crapping on the Blue Jays, credit where credit's due. The Twins did play really well. Their bats weren't amazing across the board. We'll get more to them when we talk about their series with Houston. But all I'll say is this for now. You are not off the money when you said that about Pablo Lopez. He has been the best pitcher of the postseason so far. Not particularly close, except for one individual in the National League we'll talk about later. But moreover, the Twins just played better. Props. I've not seen them play this well in the playoffs, probably in my life. Honestly, the closest was the 2017 wildcard game against the Yankees, where they looked good for, like, 2 innings. So yeah, they pitched well, they hit well enough to go on, and they got a date with the Astros as a result. So, good on you, Minnesota. Never thought I'd say that, but by God, you did it. Finally. Alright, Tom, so that's the AL wildcard rounds. I'm going to jump right into the National League now, starting with another one that we both got wrong, which I'd like the record to show. I have no hard evidence to say, but deep within my heart of hearts, I know I was going to pick Arizona.
Okay.
I was going to do it. And then this guy's going on about, oh, they're going to get curb stomped and Milwaukee, the bats just got to hang a little bit and they'll be fine. And it got me thinking, like, you know what? I like Milwaukee's pitching. It's been clutch in the past. D-backs are a little young. They're raw. Who knows? And then Milwaukee just gets their teeth kicked in. Mother of God, this series was not fun. If you were a Brewers fan, not fun. Not fun at all. But then again, Brewers fans haven't had fun since the 80s at this point. Another sweep. Are you noticing a pattern here? The Diamondbacks came out absolutely swinging, which the one thing I'll give myself was I was correct to be low on Corbin Burnes because his wishy-washiness in the regular season reared its ugly head in the postseason, enough to give up 4 runs in 4 innings and allow the D-backs to swing the door open and steal a game one win starting Brandon Pfaadt. I know he didn't get the win. He actually coughed up 7 hits in less than 3 innings, so he did not have the best start. But still, the fact that the D-backs were able to walk away with a win after a start like that from their game one guy, yeah, at that point you gotta tuck your tail between your legs and shuffle off into the offseason, a depressed, hitless team, again. God, Milwaukee's used to it by now. Their hitting was abysmal throughout the 2-game stretch. The only hitters who did anything worth a damn were Willy Adames and Christian Yelich. Everyone else was either pedestrian, you know, just kind of okay, like Mark Canna wasn't bad, but he also wasn't amazing, or they were just downright terrible. D-backs took game one 6-3 after jumping all over Corbin Burnes, Paul Sewald got the save, and then hey, guess what? Game two was basically the exact same thing, but they jumped on Freddy Peralta instead, with Paul Sewald again getting the save. D-backs owe a lot of their success to their bats like Ketel Marte, but more specifically Corbin Carroll, man, he was riding high in MVP and Rookie of the Year races early in the year. He's still a lock for Rookie of the Year. He's going to win it, no doubt. But he kind of flew under the radar a bit towards the end of the year. Yeah, he burst back onto the scene with this performance right here. He was incredible throughout the wildcard series, and he's kept it up throughout the postseason, and we'll talk about that more when the divisional round comes around. But all the rest I've got to say with this series, I'm basically done s***ing on Milwaukee, they're not worth it, is shout out to Zach Gallen, who took game two by the horns and went a whole 6 innings, only allowed 2 runs, which was plenty for Arizona to work with, and the bullpen shut it down. A good chunk of their guys back there had really good series. Joe Mantiply actually got the win in game one. Miguel Castro, another Yankees legend, actually did really well. And the aforementioned Paul Sewald was fantastic. Pitched both games, was untouchable, struck out 3, and got the save both times. So nice clean series for Arizona. Another embarrassing finish by Milwaukee. But what else is new?
See, I actually have the opposite thoughts about the Brewers in the series. Because actually looking at the box scores, the Brewers' offense was actually better than the Diamondbacks, minus the departments of runs scored and home runs. If you look at it as a team, the Brewers actually hit .309 as a batting average throughout the series. Now, this is because Willy Adames and Christian Yelich each have a batting average over .500. But there's some other guys that actually stepped up as well. Mark Canha, as Peter Rosenberg would say on the K Show, Mark Canna, in reality, .375 throughout the series. William Contreras hit .333. .309 batting average compared to .227 on Arizona's. The difference here was how they hit the ball, which was the long ball, which goes to show you in the modern postseason, if you out home run the other team, chances are you're going to win the game, but you're also going to win the series. That's what happened here. They hit more home runs. They simply won the series because, again, Milwaukee hit better as a team. And I actually remember specifically watching game one and thinking Milwaukee is probably, because Brandon Pfaadt, like, he's a meme at this point because he's starting, they won the game. He did not throw a good game. Milwaukee jumped on him early. I'm like, you know what? The curb stomping begins. Boy, do I have that wrong. Especially given that the Arizona Diamondbacks are on a 4-game winning streak in this postseason alone. So, another prediction down the gutter. But also the deciding factor is that the pitching for the Arizona Diamondbacks, their bullpen, lights out. They didn't give up a single run in the series. Each run was given up by the starting pitching. Brandon Fott, as we mentioned, mm-hmm. also Zach Gallen, who went six innings in game two. He gave up two runs. Otherwise, no runs. And that was the Arizona Diamondbacks' problem from day one this season. They had no relief help. They got some at the deadline, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, they did get some at the deadline to help them, and ultimately, I guess it paid off in the long run, believe it or not. So the Diamondbacks moved on, and yeah, the Brewers pitching completely fell apart. Not only Corbin Burnes completely had a bad day, Freddie Peralta did the exact same thing as Corbin Burnes did in game two. He didn't last very, actually, he went five innings in that one. I'm shocked they actually went the five innings, but he went the five innings, and then the bullpen did what I thought the Diamondbacks bullpen would do. Just completely lose it. So that's that with Brewers and Arizona. Oh, God. Okay, I just want to start off Philly and Miami by saying I went bold to be bold in this prediction. That is the sole reason why I picked the Marlins. I also picked the Marlins because they actually, I believe, unless I looked at it wrong, they were not undefeated. They won the series against the Phillies in the regular season, but they actually won more games at Citizens Bank when they played the Phillies than the Phillies won against them in the regular season. So I thought the success of that might transfer over. Yeah, that didn't happen at all. So I got put to shame, and I just want to say I'm not trying to hate the Phillies. They have a ravenous fan base, and their team are arguably playing the hottest. Actually, I can't say they're playing the hottest because they just lost tonight to Arizona, but they're playing unbelievably well.
Atlanta.
God, I'm an idiot.
Arizona's anyway, fresh on the brain. You're good.
Yeah, exactly. It's fresh on the brain, but yeah. Philly and Miami, this one was no contest. I'm sorry. This was Philly, Philly, Philly from minute one of this series. Outside of Josh Bell, no one could hit on this Miami offense, including the cover of MLB The Show 23 himself, Jazz Chisholm, who went 0-for-8 with four strikeouts. Yeah, their star hitter. 0-for-8,
Jesus Christ.
Four strikeouts. Talk about not showing up when it matters the most. Collectively, as a team, I just want to point this out because it's great. The Marlins hit 194. That's how terrible they were in this series. By the way, your batting champion, Luis Arraez, did nothing to contribute except one base hit. He hit 125 in this series. At least he didn't strike out. I'll give him that. Unlike Jazz Chisholm, who struck out four times, or Jorge Soler, who struck out five times in the series, going a great 1-for-8 at the dish. But at least that one was better than Jazz Chisholm's none. Haha, there you go. 4-1 and 7-1 were the finals here. Again, the Phillies really didn't have to do that much offensively, but yet they did anyway. The bats kind of erupted. Bryson Stott, of all people, hit the clutch grand slam. I believe that was in game two, I want to say, Tony, if I'm not mistaken. And that's what sealed the deal with the series. It was lights out. If you didn't see it, they put up the play and they took away the sound from it, from the broadcast, and it just chills down your spine.
Yes.
Is what happened in that Bryson Stott moment. Philly going absolutely haywire when that grand slam happened, and that's just the Philly way. They can get it done in any circumstance, really. This goes from last year into this year. It's just a well-rounded Phillies team, and they clutched up versus the Miami Marlins. Shout out to the pitching that Tony will talk about in a second of Zach Wheeler and Aaron Nola. For reasons, Tony's going to tell you.
I'll happily tell you right now, because you remember when I told you that outside of Pablo Lopez, a certain individual in the National League might also be considered the best pitcher in the postseason right now?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that individual's name is Zach Wheeler. We'll get to his performance in the divisional series in just a minute, but for the wildcard game, went 6 2/3, scattered five hits, and one run, good for a 1.35 ERA. He struck out eight, which is kind of insane in the biggest stage possible. Although, Aaron Nola actually had a better wildcard game. He's yet to pitch in the divisional series. I believe he goes in game 3. But Nola went 7 complete, only allowed 3 hits, also struck out 3, but didn't give up any runs. It was not even fair. It was not even fair. They're probably the deadliest 1-2, or at least one of the deadliest 1-2 punches, still alive in the postseason. And the Marlins, they didn't even stand a chance, man. Like, you went through their hitting well enough, so I'm not going to retread it again, but Jesus Christ, Jazz Chisholm. Did you see he did an interview with someone on the sideline who asked him why he wore, like, this space, like, the spaceship chain, and he's like, oh, I feel like because I'm out of this world, I'm so good, I'm this, I'm that.
Okay.
I'm sorry, take that and shove it up your ass. Actually play well, then you could talk like that. Like, dude, when was the last time he did anything significant in baseball other than do a little Euro step going home plate when he hits one of his, like, 15 home runs out of the year? Like, I'm sorry, I don't get the hype behind Jazz Chisholm at all. He was clearly gifted a couple years ago before the injuries set in, but now it's just kind of sad. It's like watching that kid who peaked in high school still try and talk about that one touchdown he caught in, like, sophomore year. It's like, shut up, put your head down, and be better, then I'll listen to you. But nevertheless, back to Philly. Their pitching did great. I'm surprised at how well their bullpen did, too. I know they didn't really have much to combat with the Marlins, but the only one who gave up runs was Gregory Soto, who gave up a grand total of 1. All the rest shut him down completely. And Tom, I'm going to be honest, this Phillies team is just becoming really, really fun to watch. Like, the big talk of the town this year with worst to first has been guys like, you know, Texas and Baltimore. And you definitely can't put Philly in that conversation because they just went to the World Series. But on a macro scale, you remember a couple of years ago when they could not finish above 500 to save their lives?
Yep.
They literally spent, like, over $1 billion on Bryce Harper, Gene Segura, Andrew McCutcheon, eventually JT Realmuto, and they could not get above 81 and 81. Couldn't do it. Now they're finally, I think, at their full potential. They don't even look like a complete team from the outset. Their starting pitching depth is shaky at best, their bullpen has always been a mess, and their defense has been putrid, especially since they made moves for guys like Castellanos and Schwarber. But you know what? They still succeed. They still play damn well. They go out there and mash every single day. I dare say they're a contender for one of the most fun teams to watch in baseball. It's honestly kind of refreshing for a team that has been kind of, you know, kicked where you shouldn't be kicked after 2008. Injuries to guys like Ryan Howard, seeing that core fizzle away, being absolute garbage, and now you got a new core. So, it's just good to see. I like to see that. I like the Phillies. And seeing them go on to face the juggernaut Braves, you know what? Good for them. Oh, and in case it wasn't obvious, every single wildcard series was a sweep. And the yes. Day we released the episode was after game 2s were finished. Go us.
Well, you know, Tommy, what, Tony, got, yeah, by the time the division series all wrap up, this episode's probably going to release at that point too. So we're going to look spectacular in that regard.
Probably. I mean, the good thing is it's not going to be all sweeps this time. We're going to get into it actually right now, but we are at least not at risk of that. So it'll at least still be going on by the time the episode goes out, God willing. But that all being said, Tom, wild cards are sufficiently wrapped up. Let's get into the division series, the series that are still going on right now. And we're going to start it right at the top. Texas Rangers versus the Baltimore Orioles. Welp, this is the first time I'm able to say this, Tom, but a prediction of mine is still looking really, really, really freaking good. I say that because the Texas Rangers have managed to score 14 runs across 2 games against the Orioles. They've won them both, and they've looked damn good in both games. The same hitters who were hitting really well in the wildcard series have come to play this time around. Again, shouting out Evan Carter, he's been great. Still got an OPS over 1,000. Tom shouted him out earlier, but shout out to Corey Seager. He actually set postseason history not too long ago, becoming the first man to walk 5 times in 1 postseason game. 5 walks, 1 game. Hey, you know what? They're not giving him pitches to hit, so he's making the most of it. He's hitting .250 in this round, but he has a .722 on base percentage. Jesus. That's good for a 1.62 championship win probability added, which is exactly what it sounds like, how much percentage you're contributing to your team winning. Shout out to Josh Young as well. You gave him a passing by earlier. He's been great. 375 average with an OPS well over 1300. He went yard. Mitch Garver hit a grand slam in game two. This lineup, man, does not miss. Like, they have someone who's genuinely not hitting well in Marcus Semien, but it doesn't matter because the rest of the lineup is picking him up. It's honestly really exciting to see, you know, similar vein to the Phillies hitting well. As much as Baltimore's been struggling, and Tom, I'll leave it to you to discuss how the Baltimore Orioles have not been doing the best so far, but I'll just say this, it's not their hitting. It's definitely not their hitting. All things considered, they're hitting damn well. As a team, they're hitting .333, and there are guys on this lineup like Gunnar Henderson, and Austin Hayes, and Anthony Santander, and dare I say it, Aaron Hicks, who have OPSs over or just a shade below 1,000, who are doing great things for this team. Team OPS is .819. They just got unlucky enough to match with a team with basically an identical OPS. There's just one key factor, one Achilles heel to Baltimore, and it's what sank them for two straight games. Tom, what is that?
Well, it's their pitching. As if we couldn't see this coming from a mile away with the Baltimore Orioles. It's always their pitching. It's the thing that held them back in the mid-2010s. It's the thing that's holding them back now. They've had some serious, serious issues throughout the season, and now it's kind of coming to fruition, at least with the rotation. The bullpen, I will say, has been mainly fine through the season, but that rotation is hit or miss. Grayson Rodriguez in particular, especially in game two, complete dud. He was great to end the year. I believe in his last 11 or 12 games, or maybe it was 9 games. I really don't know. They said it in the broadcast. If you listen to it, you'll know. He actually was throwing pretty well. It was like a 2-something ERA, I'm pretty sure. He was starting to look like that top prospect potential. He did not have it in this game. I mean, he gave up 5 earned runs in the 1 2/3 innings he pitched, and that's kind of where things just went really downhill from there. Brian Baker gave up 3 runs in this game. I don't even know who he is, and that's bad, but I shouldn't know who he is because he only lasted a third of an inning, and he gave up 3 runs in the postseason. I think I know all that I need to know about him. But this bullpen just unfolded to, again, this potent Texas Rangers offense. Not just the bullpen, the starting pitching did too, excuse me. So it just wasn't a good game in their perspective. And the Baltimore Orioles did make some blunders in that Grayson Rodriguez inning where he really got messed up. I believe it was the second inning of this game is when that kind of scoring eruption really began. Grayson Rodriguez maybe couldn't have lollygagged that throw at first, and then maybe things would have turned out a little bit differently. Maybe if Baltimore hadn't thrown the ball around a little bit, then they would have been a little bit better. If they had made some better decisions, if Grayson Rodriguez wouldn't walk people, then they would be in a better place. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it was their Achilles heel all season, and it's their Achilles heel now. The one thing I will say about Baltimore, too, is we're not blaming the offense, but I think we can almost blame them for not getting started quick enough. I will say in game two, they did jump out to that 2-0 lead, and then they gave up 9 unanswered runs before they finally started scoring again in the fourth inning of that game. But even in game number one, they started scoring when they were behind. So they've always been behind, really, for the most part in this series. And that's something you can't have. As much of a lethal offense as you have, if your pitching is just fragile, you gotta jump out from the gate. And again, they did that in game two, but then it just all unfolded. It's tough when your pitching can't back up that offense. And I will say, Aaron Hicks did save the score sheet a little bit in this game because they did get a rally going in that last inning. Aaron Hicks hit a clutch home run. Where has he done that with the Yankees this year? That would have been really nice. Thanks, Aaron. I'm actually glad to see he actually got some moment in the sun, though. That was actually good for him, so I'm happy for him about that. But yeah, the offense has been okay. It's just really been Texas's offense that's been the story of the series. As you mentioned, Corey Seager drew the 5 walks. He set history with that. Evan Carter's still balling out. It's just everybody's contributing on this offense. Nobody got 0 hits in this series for the Texas Rangers. It's just in every single asset, Texas is nailing in this series. And we both picked the winner of the series, Texas-Tampa, to beat Baltimore, and it's just proving us why. Is because we ultimately thought the offenses would just make the Baltimore pitching implode, and that's exactly what's really happening.
Yeah, honestly, credit to both of us for being able to see that. You know, Baltimore never really struck me as a team that could go far because of that pitching. I know I said it last time, but pitching is what wins you rings, and Baltimore staff is held together by silly putty and scotch tape at this point. You know, for what it's worth, even though they're getting absolutely destroyed in the series, and I find it hard to believe this series would go longer than 3 games at this point, this is discouraging, but at least Baltimore now has expectations. This is their first year back in relevance in God knows how many years. We knew their weaknesses. Their contention window is still wide open. Regroup, come back next year with the same hitting core, roughly, and some better pitching. And God willing, you'll get some better results, because Texas has been building this for a while. They just happen to have a speed run into let's buy the best pitching staff possible, and that finally worked for them. Develop Grayson a little more, maybe transition DL Hall to the starting rotation, see how he fares, and snag someone in free agency. Just get somebody who can anchor that core and pray John Means could stay healthy. They'll be back and they'll be better, but I find it hard to believe they come back in this series. And for Texas, one last thing, just please take it all the way. Please make me look good. Please ride this goddamn momentum into the sunset. They look amazing. They look unstoppable right now. I really hope they do it. Even if the rest of my bracket's wrong, getting this right is a major morale boost for me, for good old Tony Puglisi. But yeah, we'll have to see how that pans out. Let's talk about the other ALDS real quick. It's Minnesota versus Houston, or rather, I was going to imitate Joe Biden. I wasn't going to do that.
Do you want me to play Joe Biden again here? It would fit.
Screw it. Do it.
Minnesota!
We're screaming for Minnesota because holy shit, it's a contentious series. It's a series where one team isn't getting absolutely destroyed. Go figure. All things considered, Tom, I am astonished that of all the series, it's this one that I think is the closest. Houston versus Minnesota, to me, going into this was going to be the biggest steamrolling possible. Houston's been here 20,000 times, and Minnesota just now won their first playoff series since 2002. Lo and behold, Houston is actually, I don't want to say on the ropes, but they dropped game two to yet another dominant performance by who else but Pablo Lopez. Moreover, Minnesota's just hitting really well in this series. You remember how I mentioned that Baltimore had an 819 OPS as a team? Minnesota's got an 857. That clears Houston by a good bit. Houston's only at a 793. And you could thank guys like Royce Lewis, like Edward Julian, and like a certain former Astro come back to scorn his former team, Carlos Correa. Tom, I had no idea, because this is probably the series I've actually paid attention to the least. I had no idea Correa was doing this well. He's hitting 625 with a 667 on base and a 1,000 slugging percentage. The only thing I saw out of him was that nice play against Toronto when he caught Bo Bichette sleeping, or not sleeping, I guess. He caught him charging for home and he fired it to the plate. It gave me flashbacks of DJ LeMahieu trying to break for the plate, but that's a can of worms we're not going to open. I've already been to therapy about that, but yeah, no, Houston has surprisingly not looked terribly great. They've looked good, don't get me wrong. They took game one convincingly off the back of a Justin Verlander masterpiece, but Minnesota looks good, man. I never thought I would say that, but their bullpen still looks solid. Yoan Duran, we didn't mention him, but he looked like a monster in the wild card series, and in the one game he pitched against Houston, he looked great. I know my points here have been kind of scattershot. I'll throw it to you to talk a little more in depth about whatever you'd like, but I just wanted to lead with that, man. Minnesota is probably the team surprising me the most in this these playoffs.
Yeah, they are for me too, again, because we writ them off so quickly in the last episode. I think we went through that prediction, both of us collectively, in 30 seconds. That never happens. So yeah, Minnesota is shocking people, and believe it or not, is this really going to be the one team that knocks off the Astros early in the playoffs? Is it really going to be the Minnesota Twins of all teams? I just can't wrap my mind around that. And obviously it hasn't happened yet. Houston is an extremely, and I cannot stress this enough, an extremely good road team this year. I will give you their exact record on the road this year in 1 second as soon as I can pull it up on Baseball Reference, because they actually have a better record on the road than they do at home this year. And here is that exact record. On the road, they are 51-30. At home, they are 39-42. It may have been a stat I gave out last time, but it needs to be repeated here, because even though Minnesota actually does have a raucous crowd cheering for them back in the good old state Joe Biden likes to scream about, the Astros are an extremely lethal team, not just in the postseason, but on the road. So I feel like this series could quickly wrap up if Minnesota doesn't come out swinging like their life depends on it. Take the momentum from game two and keep it going. Keep pressing Houston. Get to that starting pitching early. Even though Houston's bullpen is their strong suit when it comes to their pitching, you got to try and knock on that door before Dusty Baker can ultimately make that call to the bullpen. Make him uncomfortable. Then it'll set you up for success, because then they have to go to the bullpen earlier, and that might run through the juice of some of the people. So if this series extends, that will be your key. You got to strike first, strike early. Carlos Correa. Jared Carrabas put this on Twitter, and I hate to admit that he's right. He is the best villain in baseball that we've seen since Alex Rodriguez. You could argue Jose Altuve, but no. I'm going Carlos Correa, because he was the guy who switched teams like A-Rod when he was hated. He obviously became more hated when he was with the Yankees, but you still get the point. The hate still carries over with Carlos Correa. He can continually get it done in the postseason. Jose Altuve's been doing fine this postseason too. Don't let me skew that in any way. But Carlos Correa is picking up his revenge on the Astros a little bit. You didn't want to pay me? Fine. I'm just going to hit extremely well against your team in the postseason. I'm going to make you regret that decision to ultimately stick a Jeremy Pena at shortstop. Obviously, it worked out for Houston because they won the World Series last year, and Jeremy Pena was extremely clutch. But Carlos Correa hitting over 400 in the series. I mean, god damn. You mentioned the defensive play that somebody had earlier. In game two, he ended it. Actually gunning out Jeremy Pena, funnily enough, running the first base on a diving stop that he had to get up and gun that ball over to first base, the quintessential shortstop play, and he nailed it to end the game in Houston to tie the series up at 1. So to me, this is the Carlos Correa show in the series. To wrap up what I'm trying to say, Carlos Correa is the reason, not the sole reason, but is a huge reason as to why the Twins are winning the series. He is everything that they've paid for, they've paid handsomely for, I should say, and he is turning out to be the guy that they can rely on. If it'll happen for them long term, that remains to be seen. But for now, you just got to kind of marvel at what Carlos Correa can do. Oh, and apparently he made history, like in the all-time postseason RBI race. I'm putting an asterisk on that because in 2017, he had like 12 or 14 RBIs that year. He should not be at 61 right now. If you do consider what MLB is not doing, and by that I mean stripping him of the numbers in 2017 and anybody else in 2017, he is not at 61 career postseason RBIs. That's where I stand on the issue. I'm not salty that he passed Jeter. He's a fantastically talented player, so congratulations to him for doing that, but that's not a stat he's actually accomplished. I just wanted to point that out because I don't know why not. I got to put some sort of damper on Carlos Correa. I can't be all sunshine and rainbows on the biggest villain in baseball.
I was going to say he's still the villain after all, regardless of how great he's been. I mean, hell, I'll be willing to forgive him this much. You can't see it, but my fingers are very close together. This much.
Yes.
If he helps eliminate Houston. Then some of it will be forgiven. Maybe that's I'll forgive true. Him for that homer he hit off J.A. Happ in the 12th inning. You know what? Too far. Never mind. Let's close the 2019 box again. Nope, not opening it again. Either way, Game 3 is actually going to be Sonny Gray versus Christian Javier. If they want to take, if by they I mean Minnesota, they want to take a stranglehold on the series, it's got to be right now. Javier was terrible all year, and Sonny Gray was amazing against Toronto. You need to jump out in Game 3. You take Game 3, you have a damn good shot to win the entire thing. So, you have a great opportunity. Please don't miss it. We've spent this entire time talking about Minnesota. I mean, deservedly so, but I'll give credit where credit's due, even if it's Houston. Like I said earlier, Justin Verlander pitched great. He went 6 strong in Game 1, got the win. As hard as the bullpen tried to give it up, I'm looking at you, Hector Neris, you're back to prime Philadelphia form with your 4 earned runs in 2/3 of an inning. Wow, nice job. Nice freaking job. Oh, and Framber Valdez also crumbled like a cookie in the beginning of game 2. That definitely cost them big time. The rest of Houston's hitting outside of Altuve is pretty pedestrian. The fact that Martin Maldonado is still getting at-bats in the playoffs. God, if the Astros were just a hair worse, they'd be way more pissed about him. But I just want to shout out one more guy before we move on, and that man is Yordan Alvarez. By God, this man does not stop hitting. He was cold for like one postseason. It was the postseason, I think, where they played the Braves. And the past two, he's just been on a goddamn revenge mission on trying to establish his name as the next big poppy. And by God, he's doing a good job of it now.
Yep.
3 home runs, 5 ribbies, a slugging percentage of 1714. Mind you, I said slugging percentage. That's higher than any OPS on the... Actually, both teams. That would be higher than both of them. Oh, and his OPS is over 2,200. That's all I have to say. He's been great. Very contentious series. Here's hoping Minnesota can pull it out. Completely biased. I don't care. Tom, if you've got anything to add, feel free to throw it in right here. Otherwise, I'll swing it over to the National League.
Yes, I'll keep it simple. Pablo Lopez. 7 shutout innings in game 2.
Yes.
7 strikeouts. 1 walk. Again, the difference maker for the Minnesota Twins. Pablo Lopez and Carlos Correa. Without those two, they ain't here right now. They're not tied 1-1. They might not even have won the series against the Blue Jays. Actually, they probably would have, because the Blue Jays always have been the postseason. But I can guarantee you it would not be a 1-1 series right now. That much I can definitely tell you.
Oh, beyond a doubt. And mother of God, the Marlins have got to be shaking their heads at that one. Granted, Luis Arraez just won a batting title, but that's also true.
And they made the postseason, technically.
But one hit in the playoffs. One meaningless single versus 2 absolute gems from Pablo Lopez. Ooh, that's their ace. That is their ace right there. Minnesota fans, you got to be proud of that. That was a damn good trade on their part.
Speaking of aces, right, Let's get into the next series.
Ooh! Tom, I think we should take a sidetrack from this little show here and go to the circus. I hear there's a left-handed ringleader in the center throwing peanuts. That was mean because I'm talking about a future Hall of Famer, but well, mother of God, Tom, I'm actually going to open this with an anecdote because I read this online and it really got me thinking. Clayton Kershaw is a surefire Hall of Famer. First ballot, one of the best pitchers ever. We both agree on this.
Absolutely.
Madison Bumgarner is not a Hall of Famer. Good pitcher in his heyday, but not quite there. We probably both agree on that too.
Of course.
Who were you trusting in Game 7?
Is this even a question? Of course I'm going to take Madison Bumgarner. It's not even up for debate.
That should not be so easy, yet it is. And it's so easy because Kershaw makes it too easy. I really don't want to keep beating the dead horse of playoff Kershaw, but mother of God, he coughed up 6 runs over a third of an inning. He got 1 out. He threw like 30 pitches and they had to pull him.
Yep.
God damn it. Oh my God, he gave up. Let's see. I actually want to pull up the exact box score of how this went because, Tom, I told you this before we started recording, but I actually caught this game when I was at a family event. I was over at my uncle's house, and he put the game on after he switched off from college football because he was tired of watching Notre Dame lose. I mean, I could have served to watch that more, but hey, honestly, watching the Dodgers absolutely die on the field was infinitely funnier. God, double on a line drive from Ketel Marte that went in and out of David Peralta's glove. That's funny. Corbin Carroll immediately singled up the middle to score Marte. Tommy Pham singled. Christian Walker crushed. I think it was a curveball or a slider from Kershaw. I thought it was leaving, but it was just a double. It scored Carroll. And then with 2 runners on, 2 runners in scoring, mother of God, he hangs the meatball to end all meatballs to Gabe Moreno, and he destroys it. Monster 3-run shot to deep left. Evan Longoria tacks on later with a double of his own, and by then Emmett Sheehan comes in the game, down 6-0. That may be the most agonizing start to a postseason game I've ever seen in my life. I want to feel bad for Dodger fans. I kind of do. But y'all have seen too many good times for way too long for me to not relish in this a little bit. Just a little bit. Do I feel bad for Kershaw? Absolutely. I just want this guy to be able to finally shed this choker label, even though he's got a ring, and pitch well in October, especially considering how depleted the Dodgers pitching staff is. He couldn't even do that. And spoiler alert for Game 2 that just ended like an hour ago, Bobby Miller didn't fare much better. I don't even think he made it through the second inning. It is not looking good in Dodgerland, Tom. Not even a little bit.
Playoff Kershaw. How about playoff curse Shaw? How about that for a pun for you? Huh? Huh?
But oh, wait, hold on, I got you. The people aren't going to be able to hear it, but you will. I hit the wrong one. There we go. It was the cricket.
I think that's really what you meant was the cricket sound effect. I think that's what you were really going for, my man.
Yeah, let's go with that. I was definitely going for that.
Ah, Jesus. Well, let me just... You gave the box score. Let me paint this in a picture, a much wider picture. His career playoff ERA before this start, which is in 194 innings pitched, was 4.22. That's already bad enough. He rose his career playoff ERA by pitching another third of an inning from 4.22 to 4.49.
Oh my God.
That's in one third of an inning. He rose his playoff ERA. Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Over 20 points. God, I feel so sorry for this. I feel so sorry for Clayton Kershaw. Dude has a 2.48 career regular season ERA, which is the best among active pitchers. He's such a great guy. He's going to have 3,000 strikeouts. He's one of the best pitchers of our generation. Instant Hall of Famer. Arguably one of the best southpaws to ever exist. Dude cannot get it done in the postseason. It's absolutely gut-wrenching. I mean, for all of America, they're probably jumping up in joy because it's the Dodgers, and any team with a nationwide audience generally is hated upon, especially if they're going against a massive underdog in the Arizona Diamondbacks. But at the end of the day, it's, unfortunately, vintage Kershaw. I can't say any more words because I feel like I'd be going down a rabbit hole of other games that I'd have to get into where the exact same thing has happened. So I'm just going to completely bypass any more Kershaw talk in favor of talking about the rest of this series. But spoiler alert, as Tony said, it just hasn't gone the Dodgers' way at all in this series. I mean, I'm pretty sure the 6 runs that the Diamondbacks scored in game 1 in that inning alone against Kershaw is more, actually it is, it's more than the Dodgers have scored all series in one inning. More than all series. 11-2 final game 1. Game 2, I don't have the stats in front of me because, again, the game just kind of ended about 20 minutes ago. The guys that need to step up for the Dodgers are not stepping up. And I'm actually going to pull up some stats now so that way I can prove that point because I was looking at that earlier and I need to call out some guys for slacking. Mookie Betts is one of them. A guy who is going to finish second in the National League MVP voting is 0-for-7 at the plate in this series. He's walked once and scored a run. One of 4 runs for the Dodgers, but that's still bad. Freddie Freeman only has 1 hit this series. Not good. I could keep going through this lineup. What you're going to find is the exact same result. This Dodgers team that was there in the regular season is simply getting outplayed in the postseason by the surprising Arizona Diamondbacks, who are on a 4-game winning streak, which is going to lead to a conversation that I think, you know what, Tony, you know what, I'm going to save it for the Braves, because that's where people are really saying that things need to change about the postseason, was because of the Atlanta Braves, who are known for their playoff successes in modern history. Since 1990, all they know is playoff success at the end of the road. So, of course, we need to follow their example. But I'm going to shut up about the Diamondbacks. I'll shut up about that for a minute. I'll let you talk more about the Dodgers and Diamondbacks if you want to. Kudos to the Diamondbacks. That's all they got to say. They're hitting around the board. Corbin Carroll is a goddamn beast.
Yeah, that's really all I wanted to say left. I want to go in on the Dodgers too, but you did a damn good job of that. The fact that Mookie Betts does not have a hit all season, that should tell you all you need to know. They're hitting like dog. You know who's not hitting like dog? The Arizona Diamondbacks. Yeah, Corbin Carroll has an OPS through the series of 1632.
Jesus.
And almost no one around him has an OPS below 850. You have to get down to Lourdes Gurriel, who homered tonight, to find an OPS below 800. Alec Thomas is hitting surprisingly well. Shout out to Tommy Pham, by the way. 4 hits in game 1, and he tacked on another 2 tonight. Like, we haven't talked about him much, Tom, but he has been low-key one of the best trade deadline acquisitions. Like, helped him get to the playoffs and is basically one of their engines here now in the playoffs. So he's been great. I already told you about Gabe Moreno and how he took Clayton Kershaw deep. Ketel Marte is obviously still hitting really well. Another 2 hits tonight for him. They look insane. They basically look like the National League equivalent of the Texas Rangers right now. Their pitching has been just as great. Merrill Kelly threw really, really well last night. And tonight, they got another solid performance out of Zach Gallen. Just a hair under 6 innings with only 2 earned runs, and the bullpen, once again, shut the door completely, capped by a third save by Paul Sewald. Yeah, Dodgers, your series is over. I don't like to be presumptuous when series are not done, but you're done. They play again on Wednesday, and they're throwing out Lance Lynn against known winner Brandon Pfaadt. So, oh, and they're on the road now, so yeah, they're done. Go ahead.
It's going to be 2 years in a row where they've lost to an NL West opponent in the NLDS. In pretty embarrassing fashion. At least with the Padres, they had the makings of a good team. The Diamondbacks, I don't think there's any excuse. This is a team that kind of came out of nowhere. Again, people are high on them, but it's the Diamondbacks.
But
when you're comparing payrolls and apples and oranges and talent level, come on now.
They had no right getting this far straight out the gate. The Dodgers should have stopped them in their tracks. And I just don't think they're the team to do that anymore, Tom, to be fair. To be frank, rather. They need some... Honestly, they're in the same place as the Orioles now, but they're well past that hill. They need pitching now if they want to stay relevant. Frankly, they need hitting depth, too, but that's an off-season episode waiting to happen. The Dodgers are at a very interesting crossroads, let's say that, because the division's about to start catching up. And by the division, I mean the Diamondbacks, and probably no one else. I'm not going to be dumb and fall for the Padres trap again, but let's continue on here. I've got pretty much nothing else to say about LA and the Diamondbacks. I'm going to move right along to the final series, that of course being Philly versus Atlanta. Ironically enough, Tom, I think it's interesting we're ending on this one because this is the series I probably have the least to say about when it comes to the actual series. You mentioned a topic earlier that I'll leave to you because you sound like you've got some opinions on it. I'm just going to jump right into it. Game one was a complete embarrassment for Atlanta. How does baseball's best lineup get held to 5 singles? You heard me. 5 harmless singles against the unmistakable might of the Phillies bullpen, including Titan of the game, the greatest reliever to ever exist, Orion Kerkering, who might take the title of one of my favorite names in baseball history right now. He carved through the bottom of that Braves lineup. Granted, he walked Acuna to lead off the next inning, but he never came around to score, so his postseason ERA is sitting at a crisp 0, which is not what I could say for Spencer Strider. Though all things considered, I'm not going to shit on Spencer Strider. He actually pitched very respectably in game one. He went, I believe, 7 innings. Yeah, he went 7 innings, 5 hits, 2 runs, only one of them was earned. Overall, pitched a solid game. Problem. The Phillies bullpen pitched better. And I really do say the Phillies bullpen. Ranger Suarez started and he went 3 2/3. The bullpen picked up the rest and they did not waver even a little bit. They were fantastic, the Braves hitters were terrible, and the Phillies did all they needed to do. Harper went yard, and Realmuto and Bryson Stott once again came through in the clutch to give them the very, 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 very easy Game 1 win. And Game 2 just wrapped up a bit ago. I'll just breeze through this one really quick. The Braves got really lucky. That's all I'm gonna say. They played well. You could call it clutch because they scored all their runs in the 6th, 7th, and 8th inning, but I'm going to call it lucky because that's honestly what it felt like. The Phillies pitching staff, and by the pitching staff, I mean Zach Wheeler, was fantastic through six innings, kind of let on some runners towards the very end, and two of them came around to score. Still pitched great, still's got a 2 ERA throughout the postseason, and he struck out 10. But the Braves did come alive in the end, managed to come away with the win thanks to a home run by Travis d'Arnaud and another two-run home run by Austin Riley. The interesting thing here, Tom, is I really don't know where the series goes from here. It's going to move to Philadelphia after this game, and I feel like the Phillies are still the favorites to bounce back considering how dead Atlanta looked over the first, 13 innings not scoring a run in the postseason? That's embarrassing. But then again, the Phillies, I believe, are starting Aaron Nola next time out. Yeah, they are. Actually, that might paint a clearer picture for Game 3, if you ask me. But I don't know. This is just a weird series. This is a very weird series right now. The Phillies have got some heroes, particularly JT Realmuto, who just came alive. He had a home run today, too, and's got an ERA, or excuse me, a OPS close to 1,200. But what are your takes so far? What do you see in this series?
I see dominant Phillies pitching, for the most part. Like you mentioned, the Braves got very lucky that they scored some runs at the end of this game. Austin Riley, notably, with that home run, actually two home runs, one of Travis d'Arnaud, because of all people, to get the Braves scoring first in the postseason, it's going to be Travis d'Arnaud. Of course, yeah. Their best player, so good that he's not even the primary catcher this year, Travis d'Arnaud. Of course he's going to be the one, former Met, good for him. And then Austin Riley, of course, hooking it over one-handed, it almost looked like. It almost looked like his right hand, or maybe it was his left hand, was the only one on the bat when he was swinging through the pitch, and he blasted that over into the left field seats or into the bullpen or wherever. It doesn't really matter. Zach Wheeler pitched a gem of a game in Game 2. Max Fried, not so much. He only lasted about four innings. But Zach Wheeler, 6 1/3, 10 strikeouts, 2 earned runs, a walk. It was actually 3 runs that they gave up, but only 2 were earned. And then Jose Alvarado shut it down for an inning. And then Titan of the game, Jeff Hoffman, gave up those last 2 runs to Austin Riley, which was the deciding factor. Braves bullpen has been okay. Actually, they've been pretty good. It's really been the starting pitching. Actually, no, not really the starting pitching that's been their problem. But for an offense that's billed as heavily as they are, and as historical as they've been, I know the Phillies are a really damn good team, and everything is clicking for them, but you gotta up the production a lot if you want to live up to the name that the Bravos have made for themselves this year. But that's not really the biggest conversation that's come through this series. The biggest conversation has come through the fact that MLB's postseason format changed, notably starting last season, where they've introduced 7 teams. Why do I keep thinking it's 7 teams? That's the NFL, dumbass. 6 teams into the playoffs in each league, extending the wild card out to be a best of 5, which everybody universally adored, I would like to point out, because that's more baseball, more contentious baseball, and just more postseason baseball. But apparently those wild card teams have been doing suspiciously well. A little too well. Because last year you saw it with the Phillies and the Padres, and I guess you can even say the Astros. And who the hell did the Astros play? They played the Yankees. I don't even want to talk about that ALCS last year. But specifically the Padres and the Phillies, let's look at. Two wild card teams that dominated in the NLDS, and then they matched up in the NLCS. The Phillies obviously taking the cake there. And this year, it's looking like it might be the same thing. The Dodgers are choking again. The Diamondbacks are up 2-0, pretty much should be a shoo-in for the NLCS, believe it or not. They were a wild card team. The Phillies are tied up 1-1 with the Braves, as if the Phillies just weren't simply a dominant team that's been arguably the third best team in the National League this season. They're 1-1. It's a little close. Minnesota is tied 1-1 with the Houston Astros, and the Texas Rangers, that last wild card team, is dominating the Baltimore Orioles. Which has led to the conversation, should the playoffs be reformatted, restructured, reseeded, once we reach the DS? Well, why should they do that? I'm genuinely asking, why should they do that? Why do we have to cater to mediocrity when it comes to October baseball on the part of one seeds? I'm trying not to scream because it's 1:30 in the evening and I've got other people in my household, but this is a huge, huge pet peeve of mine. Why do people feel the need to cater to the teams that have been dominant all year? Shouldn't you know? I don't know. If I had a week off from baseball, I'd be on the field every day, not sipping margaritas in Cancun or Florida or wherever the hell I am, preparing for the matchups, watching the video, taking extra batting practice, making extra precautions, and getting ready for that raucous home crowd in the first two games of the series. And we are fully rested for the other team that's going to have to start their number three pitcher, most likely, in the first game. We have the advantage. The home field advantage, the rest advantage, the fact that you should be the better team advantage, everything is working for you. Why do you suck in October? Why can't you come out of the gate carrying some momentum from the regular season? It's not because of that week off. You had the same gap as the All-Star break. You didn't suck then. You're just sucking now? Why do we have to cater to you playing terrible baseball when the Astros of all teams last year, they won the World Series. So if you're going to really look at it from the perspective of, oh, my team is losing because they were so good in the regular season, but now they're just choking in October. Boo-hoo. Cry about it. Think about it in the offseason when your team is sipping margaritas in Cancun, while another team that's better than your team in the month of October is playing in the World Series, making a name for themselves when your team is a laughingstock. And everybody was pointing to the Braves for this whole example. Again, why are we looking at the Braves of all teams when they choked last season to the Phillies? They might choke this season again to the Phillies when, I don't know, they won how many divisions in a row in the 90s and the 2000s? How many World Series did they make? They won one World Series and how many appearances? And how many times in a row did they choke in the NLDS when they won all those divisions, specifically in the 2000s? Why are we using them as a sample size? Why are they the team? Who cares if they might be quote-unquote America's team right now? Who cares if the Braves are losing? Play better. You have a historically great team. Play like it. That's all I gotta say. You don't have to reseed anything. Just play like you have all year. Don't suck.
It's funny, too, because in changing these playoff structures, it's more in line now with a playoff structure like the NHL. More rounds, more teams, more chaos. Let's say that. That's the hashtag they're passing around, right? Embrace the chaos, ready for chaos, some crap like that. And those are often described as the hardest playoffs. Like, the Stanley Cup is the hardest trophy to win. The MLB Commissioner's Trophy, to me at least, it's getting up there. I do agree that the Stanley Cup is probably the hardest to get considering all the things that have to break right. But considering what you have to do now as a baseball team, it is creeping up there. The only bit of devil's advocacy I will play here, Tom, I agree with you. I'll just say that straight out the gate. I don't think any sort of reseeding is necessary because, as the Astros literally demonstrated it last year, if you're a good enough team, you can work past a bye. It doesn't matter what team you face. It's just, if you're a good team, you'll be fine. Moreover, baseball players are creatures of habit, and whereas, you know, say, a bye week for an NFL team for the number one seed makes a little bit more sense because, say, oh, they only play once a week, and they've got bye weeks built into their schedule. It's a little more routine for them. Baseball players play 5 to 6 games every single week, and the only respite, like you said, is the All-Star break, once a year. So it could be that it throws off their rhythm, but I'm not gonna be the one to just throw that at the wall because number one, correlation does not equal causation. Number two, that just seems like kind of a wuss thing to say, like, oh man, I had a week on my ass, now I suck at baseball. Like, no. That's not good enough. If you're a number one seed, you shouldn't have that disadvantage. And if you do, then you shouldn't have been a number one seed. What can I say? So that's frankly the only way I could see that making any semblance of sense is that baseball players are creatures of habit, but even then, I don't think, even if that does turn out to be true, I don't think that's enough to exonerate you for playing like absolute garbage. Not to mention, let's look at the teams that they're, I suppose, feeling bad for because of this so-called disadvantage. The Braves and the Dodgers, who have had massive problems with their starting pitching, and the Orioles, who are a team that just isn't ready yet. Oh, also has starting pitching troubles. The only team that's close is Houston, which you're not supposed to feel bad for Houston. Like, I don't really have much to add to this argument outside of that little bit of devil's advocacy. It's dumb. It's stupid. Don't reseed anything. Just play better, for the love of God. Who knows? Braves fans are going to be bitching up a storm about that, and they're probably going to end up turning it around and beating the Phillies. I'm not going to bet on that, but just watch. For sheer irony and to make Braves fans look bitchier and whinier than they normally do.
No, suddenly we don't have to reseed the playoffs because the Braves won tonight, and it's 1-1. That's what exactly is happening, but watch, if the Phillies it's win the series... Quiet. Yeah, it's awfully quiet. That noise is going to continue again, and what I'm going to say is, Braves fans, you might just be taking the cake for worst fans in baseball at that point. I'm sorry. You're throwing trash onto the field because your team sucked in the postseason. You've done that multiple postseasons in a row, I'm pretty sure. I think that was last year they did that as well. You're getting up there with fans. I'm sorry. In terms of toxicity among fan bases, whining about that, that's pretty bad. I'm not saying it's the worst thing that we've seen, but because your success or lack thereof in the postseason is why we should have change, bull. Tell your team to play better. They're getting paid all that money. They're historically great. Just play like it. Oh, and by the way, in years past too, we've had gaps of days. Now, granted, it's been for both teams between series because other season series have to finish out. So I don't want to hear this momentum crap going into it. It's happened in the past too. Even if it is just for both, even if it is for both teams and not just one team, somebody's momentum can be torn just by resting for 2 days. So, sorry, I'm not buying any of that argument.
Yep, basically it. It sucks that this is the shroud of, I don't even want to say controversy, I'll say, let's say shroud of bullshit that's been cast over the series, because all things considered, it's been a pretty fun series so far. You know, not the best, not the worst, but yeah, you know, it's tied 1-1, that's more than you could say for half of them. We'll see how it goes, we'll see how the rest of these division series go. Come next episode, God willing, we'll be able to record this time next week. We'll recap the end of the division series, all of them. Obviously, we're not going to retread the entire thing, just the games we missed. And Tom, by then, it'll be time for the AL and NLCS, which, goddamn, this is moving too fast. I love how much I'm paying attention this year compared to years past. I know you mentioned that before the show as well, but damn, I'm not ready for this to be over, I tell you what.
I'm not either, but at least it's a fun ride so far. And before we wrap up this episode, I'm throwing a curveball at you. Predict your ALCS and NLCS right now.
Rangers and... God, this Twins. I want to say Twins, but I still can't, in actuality, count out the Astros. Astros, Rangers, Astros, the big battle of Texas. And then NLCS, I'll go Phillies, because Braves fans could be inconsolable. Phillies, oh, and Diamondbacks. Dodgers aren't coming back. Are you kidding me? That's the easiest one.
Well, now we can't say Tom is just going to suck, because I'm agreeing with you wholeheartedly. And I was only going to pick the Phillies just because I want the Braves fans to suffer now. So you know what? Great.
You know what? Just to be different, I'm proactively changing mine to be a little different. Twins instead of Astros. Why the hell not? Christian Javier gets shelled.
Fair enough. You know what? I would laugh at that, though. If the Twins somehow make the ALCS, one, that's just sad. But two, I will... You know what? I will state this now, and I meant to state this earlier. I will not trash the Twins much next season at all if they knock off Houston here. If it's deserved, I will trash
nice
them.
Nice throw.
But I will actively not trash the state of the Minnesota Twins that much more if they actually knock off Houston, because they'll be doing everybody a favor if they do that.
They've already largely been saved of my wrath because they won a playoff series for once, but mother of God, if they actually win the series, I might go out there and buy my ass a Twins jersey.
Yeah,
I'm not going to hold myself to that, but because I don't even know who I'd get, but if they do that, I'd like them a whole hell of a lot more, and that's coming from a Yankees fan.
All I'm saying is you do have to take a punishment, so maybe I'll make you buy a Carlos Correa Twins jersey.
Oh my God, you. I forgot about that. Make it like a Joe Mauer one or something nice, or whatever. Ooh, you know what? Maybe one of those like new ones, those like gray ones they've got, say Minnesota on it. Those aren't bad.
I'm glad you think those aren't bad, but why the hell would I be doing any of you any favors in this? This is a punishment, after all.
Bold of you to assume I'm not trying to feed you lies in order to make me pick a better jersey. What if I'm doing the old double, like a bait and switch?
Well, good for you. I'm too tired to comprehend this. That'll wrap up episode 76 of the Diamond Duo podcast. It's 1:40 at night. I'm ready to go to sleep. Tony probably is too. We've got work. I hear like a cricket noise or something coming from my house. I don't know what that is.
This is a whole new way to botch an outro.
Yeah, before I get assaulted by a bug, how about you wrap up your thoughts?
Oh, I haven't got many other thoughts. I already put them all out there, so enjoy the rest of the divisional series, folks. Hope your team does well, unless you're Astros fans. And yeah, see you next time where we talk about the championship series. Should be a fun ride.
It sure will be. Until then, thank you so much for listening to episode 76 of the Diamond Duo podcast. Again, for my partner, Tony Puglisi, I'm Tom Bauer. Make sure to give us a follow on social media on Twitter at Diamond Duo Pod, on Instagram at the Diamond Duo Podcast. Again, give us a follow or a sub, whatever it is, on Apple Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I need to slow down a little bit. Until next time, we hope you've enjoyed your wild card wrap-up and your ALDS recap to this point. Let's hope October baseball continues to give us thrills and excitement. Until next time, enjoy the baseball, folks.